I make men fall in love with an illusion, for the right price, of course. Private jets, staged kisses, curated love stories for social media. They rent the fantasy, and I play the perfect girlfriend. But one client, he didn't want to rent me. He wanted to own me. When I tried to walk away, he sent a video, proof that he'd been watching, recording, waiting. I thought he was just another narcissist. I was wrong. He was building an empire of human avatars, women he'd broken, reshaped, and sold to the highest bidder. And I was next. Now I'm trapped on his private island. No signal, no escape, unless I can con the devil at his own game, and maybe destroy one more man on my way out. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you, Boyfriend on Retainer. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, Likes, Lies, and Day Rates. Love is performance. Intimacy is branding. The rest is just lighting and angles. It always starts with a DM, late at night, somewhere between self-pity and too many glasses of bourbon. Usually from a man who owns at least one luxury watch he never winds himself. A man who knows that status isn't what you have, it's what you can make others think you have. These men don't want love, they want optics. So when I get that first message, you're gorgeous, ever do private modeling, I know what they're really asking. They want a girlfriend on retainer. Someone who can match their energy in a rooftop bar, laugh like she means it at their recycled jokes, lean in close during candlelit dinners, just enough to make exes seethe from their finstas. Someone who can play muse, trophy alibi, lover-shaped illusion. And I give it to them, flawlessly. My name is Sasha Monroe, but that's not how anyone knows me. On Instagram, I'm at that girlfriend vibe, 500,000 followers strong and climbing. My grid is a perfectly art-directed fever dream. Infinity pools in Santorini, blurred city lights through limousine windows, my legs draped over the edge of private jets. I don't live a real life, I stage one. I've built a brand out of affection for hire, relationships so glossy they shimmer under the weight of filters and ring lights. Most people chase clout for free. I invoice for it. There's a document on my phone, neat and color-coded, called the Romance Tiers. Tier 1, arm candy. Light social media. One-night events. Tier 2, weekend getaway, couple posts, PDA optional. Tier 3, exclusive. Full digital relationship. Coordinated stories, mutual follows, even fake arguments if the client wants drama. Includes emotional labor. Also includes a significant upcharge. I call what I do emotional freelancing. Men call it love. But love is just nostalgia for a thing that never existed. What I sell is the performance of devotion. I sell aspiration. And business was good, until him. Dorian Vale messaged me on a Wednesday. I was in a robe, hair wrapped in a towel, nursing a post-sponsorship headache, and halfway through scheduling a fake anniversary post for a hedge fund manager in LA. Dorian's message was simple. You have a powerful presence. Let's talk terms. Short. Elegant. No emojis. Which for me is the equivalent of a diamond ring. His profile was private, but the username was familiar. He was the ghost behind a dozen tech companies. A venture capitalist who collected startups like baseball cards. Everyone had a story about Dorian, that he'd bought his first luxury car with Bitcoin, that he once fired a CEO in the middle of a gala, that his ex-girlfriends always disappeared quietly, but somehow ended up with beach houses and nervous tics. I should have said no. Should have ghosted like I sometimes do when a man feels too aware. But curiosity is a drug, and I'm a junkie for a good mystery. We met at a private lounge in Manhattan, tucked behind a nondescript bookstore. No signage, no crowd, just a blood-red curtain and a security guard who looked like he used to kill people for money. Dorian was already seated when I arrived. No phone out, just a glass of something dark and a stare that made my skin buzz like static. Sasha, he said. I appreciate punctuality. His voice was velvet, with a blade stitched beneath it. Every syllable was deliberate, and somehow, intimate. I sat across from him and crossed my legs slowly, controlled, practiced. I was used to being the one who disarmed, but Dorian watched me like he was studying me, like he already knew my next three moves. We talked for 2 hours. Not about my services. Not really. He asked about my rules. My limits. My tells. Things that made me feel safe. But not in a kind, consent-forward way. It was more like he was profiling me, measuring the dimensions of the space I took up, and calculating how to fill it. Still, he paid. Up front. Full fee for Tier 3, plus a 30% bonus for exclusivity, and a handwritten note. You play the game well. Let's raise the stakes. That should have been my warning. But I was too busy being charmed. I was high on the way he looked at me like I was the only person in the room worth seeing. Too seduced by the precision of his world, his taste, his tailoring, the way he said my name like it was both a promise and a command. Our first trip was to a vineyard in Tuscany. He chartered a private jet with black silk headrests and a live saxophonist on board. We accidentally got photographed by a tabloid in Rome. He bought me a necklace from a boutique that didn't even exist on Google Maps. He never touched me in public, but when he looked at me, I felt possessed. The content? It was fire. My followers went insane. "Stop it, you two are unreal." Literally crying. "This is love. I want this so bad it hurts." They didn't know I was working. They didn't know love had a day rate. Dorian played the perfect boyfriend online. Supportive, protective, lavish. He commented on every post like he was obsessed. Thoughtful compliments, inside jokes, even a few slightly cryptic, poetic one-liners that got screenshotted and reposted on fan accounts. He was perfect, but it was off camera that things started to itch beneath the skin. He began noticing everything. Not just what I posted, but how I breathed when I said certain things. He tracked my energy like a biometric. He knew when I changed my skincare routine, bought me the old one, said I looked more like myself that way. He started picking the restaurants, the outfits, the filters. Then he asked me to archive an old post with a different client, one I'd shot 2 years ago. "Doesn't fit the narrative," he said, with a smile that didn't reach his eyes. It was subtle at first. Death by a thousand aesthetic suggestions. Then came the real tests. "Let's see how the public reacts if we go dark for a week. Pretend we broke up. I want to see who messages you. Would you cry for me on camera?" He never raised his voice, never touched me without permission. But I began to feel like an actress trapped in a role that had no off switch. Like the script kept changing, and I wasn't allowed to read it until I was already on set. And then, finally, I tried to quit. I wrote the message carefully. Respectful, professional, lined with gratitude. Said I was moving into a more private phase of life, taking time for spiritual recalibration, which is influencer speak for I'm burned out and tired of pretending I love you. I pressed send. 5 minutes later, my phone lit up. It was a video. Me, drunk, in Paris, saying things no one was meant to hear. Things that could ruin partnerships, kill future deals, expose other clients. I didn't even remember that night. Didn't know he'd filmed it. Didn't know he'd kept it. Then came the message. "You walk away, I leak it. Let's not play games you can't win, Sasha." That's when I knew. This wasn't a contract anymore. It was a cage. And I'd let him build it, with gold and compliments and silence, right around me. Chapter 2, Velvet Cages and Private Agendas. At first, it felt like attention. Then I realized it was surveillance. The first time I tried to run, I didn't even realize I was running. Not really. I thought it was a boundary, a professional, clean exit from a job that had run its course. I thought I could close the book the way I always had, with grace, a smile, and a carefully worded goodbye that made men feel like they'd been the ones to let me go. But Dorian wasn't a client. He was a curator, a collector, a man who didn't buy things, he possessed them. I didn't know that then. Not fully. But I knew something was off when I sent that text, and the response came too fast. Not with anger. Not even disappointment. Just a link. A video. And the message. "You walk away, I leak it. Let's not play games you can't win, Sasha." There's a particular kind of panic that only exists in silence. The kind where your heart's thudding like a war drum in your chest, but your body won't move. Where your mouth goes dry, your hands shake, and the world becomes a soundproof room you can't scream in. That's where I was, curled on the end of my designer couch in a robe that still smelled faintly of his cologne, staring at my phone like it had betrayed me. I watched the video once. Just once. It was me, all right. Paris. Hotel suite. Slurring my words in that indulgent post-photoshoot buzz. There were names in that video. Real ones. Details. Things I'd never, ever put in writing. I was always careful, obsessively so. My clients trusted me because I left no trails. But Dorian had been one step ahead. He'd waited. Watched. Collected. Every night we'd spent together, every after-hours conversation I thought had dissolved into the ether. He'd documented it. Not in a stalker-y way. Not even in a threatening one at first. It was like he saw every moment as data. As leverage. As proof of ownership. And now he was using it. I didn't respond. Couldn't. My mind ran in circles, trying to script a response that didn't reek of fear, didn't confirm guilt, didn't beg. But I knew Dorian. He didn't care about apologies. He didn't need a reason to break me. He already owned the method. So I did the only thing I could think to do. I played along. I posted a blurry photo of a wine glass, a cryptic caption about growth through conflict, and waited for the likes to roll in. The algorithm still believed in our love story. So did my followers. The world still thought I was adored, doted on, safe in the arms of a man who looked at me like I was the cure to his billion-dollar burnout. But inside, I was unraveling. That night, I couldn't sleep. I lay in my bed, every light off, my phone flipped face down on the pillow beside me like it might bite. My thoughts spiraled into worst-case scenarios. Could he hack my cloud? Forge messages? Leak things under a fake burner account and deny it? The terrifying answer was, yes. He had the resources, the connections, the will. I couldn't win in a direct fight. So I pivoted. I went back to work. More couple content. More weekends away. More stories of us drinking espresso in matching robes, kissing behind hotel curtains, walking along beaches where no one else could see us. We weren't together anymore. We were cinema. Dorian didn't even need to be in the posts anymore. His presence was implied. His shadow lingered in the details. A single cufflink on the bathroom counter. A blurry reflection in a wine glass. I made our love a ghost that haunted every pixel. And he loved it. He sent flowers. Jewelry. Books with underlined passages. Notes that said things like, "You're more beautiful when you know you're mine." It made me want to scream. But I smiled. Curated. Posted. Until one day, I didn't have to fake the fear anymore. It was a Thursday. I remember because I had a shoot in Tribeca that morning, and I wore this ridiculous lilac two-piece set that made me look like a walking macaron. I was tired, burned out. I'd taken 3 client calls, answered 2 sponsorship emails, and posted a reel that was performing below average. I was already irritated when my phone buzzed. "Dorian, you forgot to tag the hotel in today's post. Fix it." Me. "It's already performing. I can't change the tag without tanking the algorithm." "Dorian, you care more about the algorithm than us?" Me. "There is no us. You're a client." "Dorian, am I?" I froze. I reread it. Again. And again. "Am I?" That wasn't a question. It was a warning. That night he showed up. No invite. No heads up. No driver waiting downstairs. He walked into my apartment like he had a key, which he did technically. From the weekend we'd played house for a Vogue feature collab. I'd never gotten it back. I'd forgotten. And now he was standing in my kitchen, suit jacket slung over a chair, sleeves rolled up, pouring himself a glass of wine like he lived there. "Dorian." I started, voice shaking, but he raised a hand. "You look tired, Sasha. You should eat something." I didn't move. Didn't breathe. He walked closer, glass in hand, his expression unreadable. That same calm, calculated stare that had once made me feel admired now made my skin crawl. "I don't like repeating myself," he said softly. "You knew the deal. You can't just exit." "This isn't a deal anymore," I snapped, suddenly furious. "This is blackmail. What you're doing is necessary," he cut in. "It's protection. You lie for a living. You perform love like it's a subscription box. How can I know when you're being real?" "You can't. That's the point," I yelled, my voice cracking. "I'm not real. None of this is. I'm a service." He looked at me for a long, quiet moment. Then he smiled. "Not anymore." And then he left. Just like that. No threats. No violence. Just that cold, smug certainty that he didn't need to raise his voice. He had leverage. And I was too scared to call his bluff. After he left, I stood in the center of my apartment for almost an hour. Still. Silent. My robe had fallen open, but I didn't notice. My hair was wild, my hands were clenched, and my eyes were fixed on nothing. He'd made a mistake. He thought I was an ornament. A mannequin that could be dressed up, posed, owned. But I'd built an empire out of lies. And if he wanted to keep me in a cage, he'd better make damn sure it didn't have a back door. Because I was going to find it. No matter what it cost me. Chapter 3. The Man Behind the Myth. There's a special kind of horror in realizing the predator is still wearing the face you once loved. I once read a quote that said the smartest rats don't run from the maze. They map it. That's what I started doing. After Dorian showed up in my apartment like some twisted husband from a dream I never wanted to have, after he poured himself a glass of my wine like he owned the place, and maybe he did, I realized something important. I'd been playing the wrong game. I'd been reacting, panicking, flailing like a girl caught in a snare. But that's not who I am. I build illusions for a living. I live in the in-between spaces. I know how to manipulate perception better than half the PR agencies in New York. I've taken men who were walking PR disasters and turned them into saints online. I've turned bored billionaires into doting boyfriends. I've made love look so real it made people cry. I could do it again. I had to, because Dorian Vail was no longer just a bad ex-client. He was a threat, but threats bleed. And if he bled, I could find the wound. So I started digging. Not directly, of course. You can't investigate a man like Dorian through Google. He didn't live on the internet, he owned pieces of it. His name wasn't attached to his money, not really. He used shells and proxies and offshore accounts and foundations with names like the Meridian Group and Phoenix Equity Trust. Philanthropic on the surface. Almost saintly. But there's always a crack in the mask. The first one came from a girl named Ainsley. I remembered her vaguely, an influencer from a couple years back. Not massive, but curated. Artsy. Expensive taste. She'd vanished suddenly. Deleted her account mid-rise. Her page went dark right after she'd posted a mysterious shot. A man's hand, heavy watch, resting on her thigh in a G-Wagon. I remembered the watch. It was the same one Dorian wore. I found her LinkedIn through a beauty brand collab tag. She hadn't updated it since 2022. Her last listed job was creative consultant. A meaningless title, a red flag in disguise. But I still had friends. Contacts. A little well-placed flirting, a little subtle manipulation, and within a week, I got an address. Ainsley was living in Miami. Not working. No socials. No public photos. Not even tagged in anything. Ghosted from the grid. Which, in my world, is like being buried alive. So I flew down. I booked a hotel under an alias I'd used for NDA-heavy jobs, Maya Loren. Burned account. No connection to Sasha Monroe or that girlfriend vibe. Just a shell with a pair of oversized sunglasses and a suitcase full of pre-scheduled content to make it look like I was sipping spritzes in Capri. I found her building easily enough. Luxury, but not ostentatious. Quiet. Gated. I waited outside with a coffee and a book I didn't read until I saw her. Thinner than I remembered. Pale. Walking a dog that didn't match her brand at all. A grumpy little mutt with cloudy eyes and a chewed-up leash. She didn't recognize me at first. I'd changed my hair. But when I said her name, gently, she flinched like I'd slapped her. "I don't know you," she said, voice sharp. "Yes, you do," I said. We worked the same grid. Something in her face shifted. Her eyes darted around, paranoid. "I'm not part of it anymore." "I know. That's why I'm here." She hesitated. Then, finally, motioned for me to follow her inside. No words. Just a twitch of her fingers. Her apartment was clinically clean. Not designer. Not aesthetic. Just practical. Like someone had scrubbed the personality out of it. She made us tea without asking if I wanted it. Poured two cups and sat across from me like we were old enemies forced to play nice. "You're with him?" she asked eventually. I didn't answer. Her eyes flicked up to mine. "You were." I nodded. She didn't say anything for a long time. Just stared into her cup. "He's not what you think," she said finally. "He doesn't date women. He processes them." "Processes?" Ainsley swallowed hard. Her knuckles were white around the ceramic. "Dorian doesn't fall in love. He acquires. Studies. Reprograms. And when he's done, when you stop being useful, he sells access to you." My blood went cold. "You're saying, what, he's a trafficker?" She didn't nod. Didn't look at me. Just said very quietly, "Not in the way you think. He doesn't sell sex. He sells control. Image. Ownership. Men pay to have the fantasy version of you. The one he built. Not the real you." I didn't understand. "Not really. Not yet." She continued, voice like sandpaper. "He made me delete everything. Made me stay in. Told me the sun would ruin my skin. That I was better on camera. That I belonged in a house, not in the world. And then one day, I wasn't mine anymore." She looked up, eyes hollow. "I don't know how I got out. I think someone paid him. Bought me out of the contract. A silent investor, maybe. But I don't exist anymore. Not the version I was. I live here. Quiet. I don't post. I don't model. I don't smile." We sat in silence. The walls were so still, I could hear the ticking of a clock in the hallway. I left without saying goodbye. There was nothing to say. When I got back to my hotel, I threw up. It was the first time since I was 15 that I'd felt that kind of nausea. Not food poisoning. Not nerves. existential panic. What Ainsley had described wasn't just abuse. It wasn't just manipulation. It was systematic erasure. A machine disguised as a man. And I was next. Back in New York, I tried to act normal. I posted stories. I tagged brands. I took mirror selfies with motivational quotes and responded to comments with my usual mix of flirty banter and breezy detachment. But inside, I was unraveling. I started to notice things. My apartment had been cleaned when I hadn't cleaned it. Not once, twice. My trash was taken out when it was still only half full. A package arrived that I hadn't ordered. Not in my name. No sender. Inside, a silk scarf. My favorite color. A note. I missed this on you. No signature. Just the scent of his cologne. He was watching. Waiting. And I couldn't run, not yet. So I did what I always do. I smiled. Posted. And started planning my escape like it was just another campaign. Because I wasn't going to disappear. I was going to destroy him first. Chapter 4, Pretty Lies and Loaded Smiles. To outcon a monster, you have to become something colder than fear, something hungrier than love. There's something about performance that rewires your brain. You start to forget where the mask ends and your skin begins. You smile so much your cheeks ache, but you keep smiling. You flirt while calculating escape routes. You sip wine and laugh and bat your lashes. All while your stomach churns and your hands tremble in your lap. It's not bravery. It's instinct. And I've honed that instinct into an art form. By the time I returned from Miami, I wasn't the same woman who'd sat at Dorian Vale's table, sipping $300 champagne and thinking I was the one pulling the strings. I was done playing house. Done pretending. He thought I was still his puppet. Still trapped. But I was already unraveling the threads. The first thing I did was purge. Not my feed. That had to remain untouched. Any deviation from our relationship would draw suspicion. No, I purged my life. Got a burner phone. Used cash for everything. Turned off every smart device in my apartment. Wiped my cloud. I even dumped my main laptop and bought a secondhand one from a thrift shop in Jersey. You'd be amazed how much of your life you leave behind in the digital smudges. And Dorian? He lived in those shadows. He knew how to trace footprints no one else could see. So I stopped walking where he could follow. And then I started plotting. The question was simple, but devastating. How do you trap a man who lives in a house made of traps? Dorian wasn't reckless. He was obsessive, methodical. Every move he made was 2 steps ahead of logic, 5 steps ahead of emotion. You couldn't scream your way out. Couldn't cry, couldn't beg. He wasn't moved by feelings. He was moved by control. So I needed to become the thing he couldn't control. Unpredictable. Dangerous. Irreplaceable. I started with a decoy. A new client. Fabricated, of course. I created an entire identity. Julian Kane. A moody venture capitalist with a tragic backstory. A curated Instagram full of moody black and white photos. And a verified badge I acquired through a shady backdoor contact I knew from my early influencer days. Julian followed me. Commented on a few photos. Sent a DM. I replied. Slowly. Casually. 2 days later, I posted a story of 2 drinks clinking over a rooftop view. 1 glass mine. 1 his. Just enough to suggest curiosity. Dorian took the bait immediately. That night, he texted me for the first time in days. Dorian, who is he? Me, a fan. Why? Dorian, you're not allowed fans. Me. Wasn't aware I'd signed a lease on my soul. Dorian, you did. With your eyes. Don't pretend otherwise. Me. And here I thought I was just your investment. Dorian, you're both. Which is why you'll stay right where you are. It made my blood freeze. But also it made me smile. Because he was slipping. Dorian didn't get emotional. But jealousy? That was the crack in his armor. He wanted control. But control laced with desire. That was harder to sustain. I had leverage. A wedge. I just needed to push deeper. So I made Julian bolder. More stories. More messages. A staged photo of his hand on my back during a night out at a downtown gallery. I even hired a body double for a single paparazzi-style snap outside a Michelin star restaurant. Just enough blur. Just enough suggestion. Dorian's responses turned colder. Not angry. Not yet. But, pointed. Dorian. If you want me to remind you who you belong to, I can. Me. I don't belong to anyone. Dorian. That's not how this ends, Sasha. He stopped texting after that. But his silence was louder than words. 2 days later, I came home to find a key card slid under my door. No note. No explanation. Just a date. and a city, St. Lucia. At first, I thought, escape, a real vacation, maybe even a test, but something about it felt final. I Googled the resort on the key card. There was no listing, no social media, no address. Just a vague mention of a private property owned by an investment group Dorian was loosely connected to. I sat in silence staring at it. My first instinct? Burn it. My second? Go. Because that was where the answers were. That was where the real Sasha, the one Dorian had tried to erase, could confront the myth in the flesh. It wasn't enough to run. He'd always be a ghost in the system if I didn't face him down. On his turf. But I wouldn't go unarmed. So I reached out to someone I'd been avoiding. His name was Marcus. We dated once, briefly, before I ever started the rent-a-lover business. Before I learned that love was less reliable than direct deposit. He was a cybersecurity consultant who moonlit as an ethical hacker for private firms. Smart. Kind. Still maybe a little in love with me. I met him at a bookstore in Brooklyn. Told him just enough to scare him. Not the trafficking ring. Not the full Dorian profile. Just the stalking. The control. The threats. He offered me his couch. I declined. I needed plausible deniability. Instead, I asked him to build me a tracking bug. Something invisible. Small. He didn't ask questions. Just handed me a pendant. A gorgeous, vintage gold charm that looked like something I'd buy myself on impulse during a trip to Florence. It's GPS-linked and audio-capable, he said, slipping it into my hand. Battery life's about a week. It activates once you land outside the States. Just make sure it stays on you. I kissed his cheek. Told him he was a lifesaver. I didn't say I might not come back. I packed light. No phone. No laptop. Just burner IDs, a few staged photos of Julian, I could use if needed, and that necklace. When I boarded Dorian's private jet, I wore my best mask. Neutral makeup. Soft waves. Neutral dress. Eyes wide. Smile shy. Every inch of me designed to look just the right amount of submissive and seduced. The flight attendant smiled like she'd seen it all before. The plane interior was sinfully luxurious. Leather, wood, the scent of power and polish. But I barely noticed, because Dorian was already waiting in the back, sitting in a wide, cream leather armchair with a drink in his hand and a look in his eyes I couldn't decipher. He didn't stand when I entered, just raised his glass. To second chances. I sat opposite him. To clarity, I replied. He smiled, but behind that smile was something hollow, something hungry, something I was about to face alone, on an island with no return ticket. And I had one thought echoing in my mind as the wheels lifted off. This isn't a vacation. It's a vault. And I'd just locked myself inside. Chapter 5. The Island That Doesn't Exist. The most beautiful prisons are the ones you decorate yourself. It looked like paradise. From the air, the island was a postcard. Lush hills, bone-white beaches, and waters so violently turquoise they looked photoshopped. As the jet circled lower, the jungle glittered like emeralds soaked in sunlight. A winding dock curved out into the sea like a beckoning hand. It was the kind of place people post on Instagram with captions like, heaven on earth. But I knew better. This wasn't heaven. It was curated hell. The jet touched down on a private runway that barely looked like it belonged to civilization. No air traffic tower. No hangars. Just a strip carved into the island like a secret. Dorian stepped off first, wearing tailored linen and bare feet, like some colonial king playing casual. He held out a hand like I was a guest at a wedding, not a woman trapped in her own survival script. I didn't take his hand. I smiled instead. Beautiful, I said, looking around, heart slamming like a trapped bird in my chest. You've outdone yourself. He laughed, low and warm, like he believed I meant it. Maybe he wanted to believe. This island doesn't appear on most maps, he said, leading me to the sleek black SUV waiting at the edge of the landing strip. Bought it through a holding group 2 years ago. Renovated everything. Brought in my own contractors. Full security grid. Satellite linked. He said it like someone listing amenities on a luxury Airbnb. But what I heard was, no one knows you're here. No one's coming if you scream. The driver wore mirrored sunglasses and no expression. His hands never left 10 and 2. Dorian talked as we drove, pointing out invisible landmarks, the hidden helipad, the desalination facility, the backup generators. He was proud of it all. And I realized something sickening. He didn't just want control. He wanted legacy. A self-sustaining kingdom. A world where he was god and lover and lawmaker all in one. The villa was carved into the cliffs above the ocean, designed to look like it had grown out of the rock. All white stone and minimalist edges. an infinity pool spilling into the horizon, hammocks swaying over the drop, flowering vines crawling up marble columns. It was absurdly, aggressively perfect. But the windows didn't open. The locks clicked from the outside. There were no door handles on some of the rooms. Subtle things. Easy to miss, if you weren't looking. But I was. The interior was curated like a boutique hotel. Nothing personal. No books, no clutter, no signs of actual living. Just the kind of sleek opulence you see in magazines, all soft neutrals and expensive silence. He gave me a tour like we were honeymooners. "This will be your room," he said, opening a door to a suite larger than most apartments. King bed, walk-in closet, a balcony that looked out over the water. I turned in a slow circle. No visible cameras, no microphones, but I knew better. "Where's yours?" I asked. He smiled. "Next door, but I imagine I'll be in yours more often." I laughed like he was funny. Inside, I counted exits. Floorboards. Breakable objects. That night, we dined under the stars on the upper terrace. A chef I hadn't seen prepared grilled fish, citrus salad, wine that tasted like melted gold. Dorian talked about power like it was love, spoke about the world like it was a machine only he understood. "You know what makes people so easy to manipulate?" he asked, cutting into his food. "They want to believe in a story more than they want to believe in truth. It's not the facts that bind us, it's the fantasy." I looked at him, expression soft. "You think love is a fantasy?" He smiled without teeth. "I think it's the most dangerous one." Later, in the dark, he kissed me like nothing had ever gone wrong. His hands were gentle. His mouth was slow. I let it happen. Played the part. Moaned when I had to. Touched his face with fingers that ached to claw instead. When he finally fell asleep, sprawled across the bed like a king without fear, I slipped out and checked every inch of the villa. The windows were sealed. The doors locked from outside. Even the Wi-Fi was password locked behind a private firewall. No signal beyond the local server. My burner phone was useless here. GPS disabled. My pendant tracker, though, still tucked under my shirt. Still on. I could only hope Marcus was watching. And then I found it. Behind a locked door on the ground floor. A security panel. I watched the pattern Dorian used earlier. Four numbers entered fast. I guessed it after three tries. The door hissed open. Inside, a hallway. Cold. Sterile. A sharp contrast to the warmth upstairs. And at the end of that hallway, rooms. Rooms with beds. Desks. Mirrored glass. And cameras. Not just rooms. Cells. Some empty. Some not. I saw a woman. Sitting cross-legged on the floor. Long hair. Too thin. She didn't look up when I opened the door. Just rocked slightly, like she was listening to music that didn't exist anymore. Another room, empty but used. Restraint marks on the bedposts. Scratches on the wall. A third room. Equipment. Computers. Footage. Monitors that looped with streams of women in different outfits, voices whispering in rehearsed affection. Fake relationships. Staged proposals. Kisses against green screens. And I understood. This wasn't just a sanctuary. It was a factory. Dorian wasn't trafficking bodies. He was trafficking narratives. He turned women into living avatars of desire, memory, and performance and sold them. Not sexually. Emotionally. Digitally. Wealthy clients could buy access to them. Script interactions. Customize experiences. Like high-end dating sims, only real. The women never left. Not physically. Not digitally. They became property. I almost screamed. Almost sobbed. But I didn't. Because I had to get out. I closed the door. Slipped back upstairs. Climbed into bed like I hadn't just seen hell behind a luxury wine rack. Dorian was still asleep, face peaceful. I watched him. And I whispered, so quietly even the cameras couldn't hear it. "You should have picked a different girl to cage. Because I wasn't going to die here. I was going to burn this whole empire to the ground." Chapter 6, Queen's Gambit. Some traps look like open doors. Some escapes require becoming something you swore you'd never be. Every revolution begins in silence. Not in gunfire. Not in declarations. Just the quiet click of something inside you snapping into place. The moment you stop waiting to be rescued, and start designing your own salvation. For me, that moment came at 3:42 a.m. I lay in bed next to a man I used to think I could outmaneuver, watching the light from the hallway under the door. I hadn't slept. Not since I saw what was hidden beneath the villa. The cells, the women, the footage. Dorian didn't run an island retreat. He ran a boutique trafficking empire disguised as a love story. And I was his next product line. I could feel it in the way he touched me now, like he was sculpting something. Like he was preparing me for launch. He thought I was moldable. But you can't mold fire. You just contain it. And I was done being contained. The first step was small, obedience. I became exactly what he wanted. Soft-spoken. Yielding. I asked him to read to me from his favorite books. I let him teach me chess by the pool, nodding like I was impressed by every move. I wore what he laid out for me, silks, linens, nothing with structure. I laughed at his dry, predatory jokes. "Are you happy here?" he asked one night. I looked at him and said, "I've never felt safer." It was a lie dipped in honey, and he swallowed it whole. That's the trick. You don't scream when you're in the lion's den. You purr. You curl up next to him and wait until his back is turned. Then you claw your way out. I started mapping the island in my head. Every path, every checkpoint, every camera. The staff was minimal. 3 men I only saw in passing. Silent, obedient. Dorian called them assistants, but they moved like former mercenaries. Military shoulders. Minimal eye contact. One of them I named Scar, because of the thick gash running down his jaw. Scar watched me the most. I needed to get rid of him first. But I also needed time. And for time I needed distraction. So I staged one. A panic attack. It happened mid-breakfast, eggs and tropical fruit, our usual setup. I made my hands shake, forced my breathing into fast, shallow gasps, let my eyes glass over with pretend trauma. "I had a dream," I whispered, voice cracked. I saw myself in one of the rooms. Dorian froze. My heart kicked hard in my chest. I had to pivot. "Not one of your rooms," I said quickly. "A different one. From my childhood. Locked in. Alone. I think being here triggered something." His jaw unclenched. "Slightly. I didn't know you had claustrophobia," he said, tone suddenly gentle. I nodded. That night, he gave me a sedative to help me rest. I hid it under my tongue and spit it into a napkin when he turned away. He was slipping, because he believed I was fragile. He didn't know I was sharpening every broken piece of myself into a blade. The next day, I faked dizziness during yoga, collapsed in the sand during our beach walk. Scar came running. I flinched when he touched me on purpose. "Please don't let him touch me," I whispered to Dorian. Scar was reassigned the next morning. One threat removed. I found the security room 2 nights later. Locked behind a keypad I already knew the code to, Dorian reused the same sequence for everything. 0729. His birthday. Narcissists never hide the things they think define them. Inside the room, monitors. Live feeds. Footage of every corridor, every angle. Including mine. I was everywhere. Sleeping. Showering. Eating. Even crying once, alone on the terrace. It was all stored on a server I couldn't access from inside the system. But I didn't need access. I just needed interference. So I staged a power outage. That required timing. And a little bit of sabotage. The next morning, I tripped the irrigation pump by flooding one of the garden valves near the east wing. It overloaded the generator's secondary grid. The lights flickered. The cameras glitched. I had 7 minutes. I used every second. Down the hall. Into the basement. Past the security door. Pendant still tucked against my chest, tracking my every step. Inside the same room I'd seen before, the one with the equipment, I grabbed a flash drive from a desk drawer. Plugged it into the primary console. Copied what I could. A folder labeled client packages. Another labeled beta tests. One titled Sasha, V.1. I almost vomited. I didn't open it. I couldn't. I took the drive. Slipped it into the hem of my dress. Stitched with a hidden pocket, I'd sewn myself using a makeup needle and thread. Then I walked back upstairs like nothing happened. Dorian never noticed. But Scar did. He was back. I saw him outside my door the next night. Not watching. Listening. I needed to move faster. So I escalated the act. I started talking in my sleep. Whispers, murmurs. Just loud enough to be heard. Fragments. Names. Questions. Once I muttered Julian. The next morning Dorian was cold. Distant. But I saw something new in his eyes. Fear. He didn't ask who Julian was. He didn't need to. He thought I was haunted. That I was unraveling. Which meant he didn't expect me to be capable of escape. Which made me more dangerous than ever. 3 days later, the opportunity came. A storm hit the island. Tropical, violent, unforecasted. The power flickered. The perimeter grid reset. And in that 30-minute window when the system rebooted, I made my move. I dressed in black. No shoes. No lights. Just the pendant tracker, the flash drive, and the knife I'd stolen from the kitchen and wrapped in cloth. I slipped down the cliffside path I'd memorized during our morning walks. My fingers bled on the rocks. My knees tore open when I slipped, but I didn't stop, because I knew where the satellite tower was. Marcus told me to activate the pendant near the highest, clearest point. The tower sat at the island's edge, just above the sea, beside the service dock where small boats ferried supplies. I reached it just as the first rays of morning cracked the storm clouds. Collapsed beside it, pulled the pendant free and pressed the hidden button 3 times. Once, twice, third time, hold. I waited, heart pounding. Nothing, no sound, no sign. For 30 seconds, I thought I'd failed. Thought Marcus had forgotten me, that I'd flown to my own funeral. And then, a ping, barely audible, but real. My signal had gone through. Now all I had to do was survive until help arrived. Except, I turned, and Scar was standing at the tree line, watching me, expression unreadable, gun at his hip. I ran, but I already knew. He wasn't going to shoot me. He was going to take me back. And Dorian? Dorian would kill the girl I'd once been, and build someone new in her place. Unless I played my last card. Chapter 7, The Con That Saved Me. Sometimes, to be free, you have to become the thing you fear. Sometimes survival costs more than your soul. It costs your innocence. Scar didn't move. He just stood there at the edge of the jungle, half in shadow, half in sunrise, the gun at his hip glinting like a promise. My legs were shaking, knees scraped raw. My body was exhausted, soaked from the storm, trembling from adrenaline. I knew if I tried to run again, he'd catch me. Maybe not kill me. But worse, he'd drag me back to Dorian. Back to the villa. Back to the rooms with no handles. I stood slowly, pendant still clutched in my fist, praying the signal had gone through. "Don't," I said, voice hoarse. "Please." He tilted his head, studying me like a predator with time to kill. "You have no idea what's waiting for you when you go back," I said, teeth chattering. "He's not done with you either, you know. He'll use you until you're dust." Something flickered in his eyes. I couldn't tell if it was recognition or pity. "You think he lets anyone leave?" I said. "You think I'm the first who tried?" He didn't speak, but he didn't reach for the gun either. I took a step back, and another. Then I turned, and ran. I didn't know where. I just knew I had to move. If the signal had gone through, someone would come. Marcus had contacts. Military ones. People who knew how to trace encrypted locations. He told me once years ago, "If you ever disappear and I get that signal, I won't stop until I find you." I prayed he still meant it. Behind me, Scar followed, quiet as death. I could hear his footsteps breaking through leaves and mud. But he wasn't rushing. He didn't have to. I was wounded. Slower. Slipping. I made it back to the cliffs. And that's when Dorian stepped into view. He was waiting for me. Of course he was. He wore white. Always white. A linen shirt open at the collar, barefoot, calm as a summer breeze. The storm had cleared, but the sky behind him was still bruised, still mourning. "Did you really think you could run?" he said. I didn't answer. He stepped closer. "You've been playing a dangerous game, Sasha." He looked almost sad, like a disappointed father, or a man watching his favorite painting burn. "I gave you everything," he said. "A new life. A legacy. A place in history. And this is what you choose. Running through the mud like an animal." I shook my head. "You didn't give me a life," I spat. "You stole it. You curated it. Built it out of wire and glass and lies." He smiled. "I curated you." And just like that, the switch flipped. I wasn't afraid anymore. Because the man standing in front of me wasn't a god. He wasn't a king. He was a rich, broken boy who played with dolls and called it devotion. "You don't love women," I said. "You collect them. Like weapons. Like art. But we're not yours." He stepped closer. I stepped back. Edge of the cliff behind me now. Nowhere left to go. "You're mine," he said, voice low. "You always were." And that's when I pulled the knife. It wasn't big, just a kitchen blade, but I gripped it like it could rewrite fate. He blinked, surprised. "I don't want to kill you," I said, "but I will." He laughed and lunged. We collided in the mud. I slashed wildly, blindly. He grabbed my wrists. His weight crushed me. I could smell his cologne, sandalwood, bergamot blood. "You can't hurt me," he hissed. I smiled and whispered, "I already have," because I wasn't alone. I heard the rotor before I saw the blades. A low, thunderous beat rising from the east, helicopters. Then shouts. Men in black. Guns raised. Tactical gear. Storming the beach. Someone screamed my name, Marcus. Dorian looked up, distracted. I didn't hesitate. I drove the knife into his shoulder. Deep. All the way. He roared and fell back. I scrambled up, slipping, sprinting toward the cliffside clearing. Toward the sound of rescue. Marcus reached me first, grabbing me by the arms. Jesus, Sasha, are you? No time, I gasped. There are women. Below the house. Locked rooms. Files. Everything. It's all there. He nodded to the men behind him. They moved fast, spreading out. Dorian didn't run. He stood at the cliff's edge, bleeding, watching it all. The empire he'd built, coming down piece by piece. I'll rebuild, he said softly. You know I will. I walked toward him, covered in bruises and blood. Maybe, I said. But not with me. He smiled. And jumped. I screamed. Ran to the edge. But he was gone. No splash. No body. Just waves crashing against the rocks. They searched for hours. Never found him. Not his body. Not his bones. Nothing. The next few weeks were a blur. Deprogramming. Interviews. Testimony. Therapy. The women were rescued. 9 in total. Some barely remembered their real names. Others cried at sunlight. They found files. Contracts. Video proof. Enough to bury Dorian for life. If he was still alive. But no one knew. Not really. Marcus stayed with me the whole time. Never asked what happened in the villa. Never pushed. You don't owe me a story, he said. Just a future. I wanted to believe him. But the truth? I didn't know who I was anymore. Not really. The woman I'd been. The curated girlfriend, the luxury con artist, the digital illusion, she was gone. Burned to ash in that marble palace by the sea. And what was left was something new. Something jagged. 6 months later, I moved to London. New name. New passport. Marcus helped me build an identity strong enough to vanish behind. But I couldn't stay invisible forever. Because one day someone will ask, whatever happened to Sasha Monroe? And someone will say, she disappeared. Like smoke. And maybe that's true. But what they won't know is that I've already begun building something new. A project. A mission. Helping women disappear, before men like Dorian find them. I call it Ghost Light. And the first woman I helped vanish? Her name was Ainsley. She's free now. And me? I'm not free yet. But I'm close. One con at a time.